Welcome to Wise and Nice, a true crime podcast with your hosts
Danny Armstrong
and Kelly Lee.
Please remember that we mean no disrespect to anyone mentioned in this episode or across any of the Wise and Nice platforms. We have an interest in true crime and related topics, and whilst we may offer our own personal views on certain items, it is meant to be educational and as light-hearted as possible. The information we present is collated from research gathered from the internet, and we reference and credit our sources wherever possible.
If you've liked what you've heard and want to join in with us, follow us on our socials, Instagram, Wives and Knives the Pod, Twitter, at Knives Wives, and Facebook, Wives and Knives Pod. We also have a little website where we post photographs and other information about the cases that we research. And this is wivesandknives.wixsite.com/my site.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Wives and Knives.
Yes, hello everybody.
Yeah, hope you're all doing well out there. This is just a little mini of historical cases for you. But first, Kelly, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Just busy as usual. I'm slightly perturbed about how close Christmas is. I'm feeling very organised.
Yes, Christmas is like super soon now. What stresses me out is how many weekends I've got left till Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. And paydays as well.
Oh, like fucking one.
Yeah, exactly.
Really?
I'm like, ugh, how depressing.
I'm okay. Like, present-wise, if Christmas was tomorrow, everybody that I need to get something for would get something.
No, I'm not there. Everyone would get something, but it would probably just be like a wrapped up something from my house. I'm not. Well, I'm there for Cassidy. She's always my first priority because it's, you know, kids. They love Christmas, don't they? But for everybody else, not so much. So, but I'll get there. I always do.
Yeah, you know, I'm pretty good, pretty organised with that. What I'm not organised with is my time.
Yeah.
And not to make out like I'm not super popular or anything, but there's loads of people that have been like, oh yeah, we'll do something around Christmas.
Oh, yeah, I'm like that all the time. Like, one of my oldest friends I've not seen for months, and we've been trying to get together, and it's always like something comes up or, you know, you're just busy. So we've got a date in for early December, but again, there's just no time.
Yeah, and then it's like all these meetups actually do cost money as well.
Yeah, totally.
So yeah, that's, I'm a bit stressed about time more than anything else, but you know what, it is what it is, and I really like Christmas. So
yeah, love Christmas. That's about it really for me. What about yourself?
I'm all good. Been like, yeah, like I say, like catching up with people and stuff. I had a poem, so I write poems for fun, and I had a poem like used by a men's mental health charity called Two Pints Deep, and they made like a promotional video sort of raising awareness for National Men's Day, which was yesterday, and they used my poem on it. And as much as it is cringy as fuck listening to your own voice, but obviously I do a podcast, so I'm kind of used to it, but when you have written something and then it's like released to the world, I think it's really nervy, but I'm also proud of it, so there we go.
Should definitely be proud of it. We should try and we should share it with our listeners and then they can have a listen too.
Yeah, feel free. Like, I, like Gareth, my husband, was like, oh, I want to share it. And I'm like, oh, cringing, because there's loads of, like, especially like his friends that don't know that I write poetry, and then they'll be listening to it and I feel a little bit exposed. But also, like, I am proud of it. So, yes. But the video they've made it into is really cool, and I think they've done a really good job. So,
yeah, we're definitely gonna share it. It's okay. You're just gonna have to live with it, I'm afraid. with the cringe.
I will. And it is for such a good cause and such an amazing charity. Yeah. So there we go. So that's the most exciting thing I've done really this week.
Lovely.
And then there's, as I don't know if I've mentioned this before, there's loads of building work going on in my house at the moment. And my house is so cold and so noisy, even when the builders aren't here, because there's like a tarpaulin as a roof and the weather's been so bad. The tarpaulin like slaps. So it gets windy and all you can hear is... Honestly, and the dog is like, what is that? So he's running around and yeah, I'll just be glad when it's all done. But I don't think anyone really likes having like building work going on. So
no,
it is what it is. And I'm feeling confident now. Now I can see the progression that when it is done, it will be a vast improvement. So we're all good.
Yeah. And you're nearly there. So
we are nearly there.
Yeah.
So, would you like to go first with your case?
Well, I can do. Yeah, why not?
Go for it.
So, as Danny said, we're going to do two small historical cases. Mine is from America. It takes place in the late 1800s. So, in the 19th century, the American government had a lot of land out west, but the land was relatively empty. So I take that to mean that not many white people lived out there. And so to fix this so-called problem, the government began offering plots of land to anyone who was willing to move out there and like farm it.
Right.
So one family of four who took them upon this offer were the Benders. Is it me or did... like Bender used to be quite a homophobic slur back in the 90s. Am I right? So
it reminds me of the robot from Futurama.
Oh yeah, Bender. Yeah. Yeah, he is. Okay, so this family of four who went out west were the family were called the Benders, and the family consisted of Father John Bender Sr., his wife Elvira, who was known as Ma Bender.
Such a good name.
Totally. Their daughter Kate and their older son John Jr. So in the autumn of 1871, the Bender family arrived and built a small house on the Osage Trail in Labette County, Kansas. Now, this house and its accompanying land was part of like a larger settlement or community that had been founded by a group of spiritualists. So for those that don't know, spiritualism teaches that the spirits of the dead continue to live on after death. And spiritualists of the time like often practiced seances to contact these ghosts. So you can imagine that it was quite unusual or unorthodox for some people of that time. Like it was a little bit weird perhaps.
Yeah.
But the Benders fit right into this community because they were perceived to be a little bit weird themselves.
Yeah.
So Kate Bender, she quickly gained a reputation as a psychic and healer who could talk to the dead. And even in a community of spiritualists, her sort of talks and her sermons on different subjects, including like free love, were considered a little bit odd. And John Jr., he like had a tendency to laugh aimlessly, which led many to think that he might be like mentally ill,
like the doctor from The Simpsons.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Like, he like tells you something really bad and then he goes
yeah. So they were a bit of an oddball group. Like the dad didn't, he was like in his 60s and he didn't really speak much English. So they were classed as like an odd family.
Yeah.
So to set the scene a little bit, if you imagine like a big sprawling space with not many like houses or farms, and what farms that there were or what homesteads that there were. There's like lots of land between them, like miles and miles.
Yeah, so it's quite desolate.
Absolutely. And particularly because of the opportunities to, you know, have these plots of land, there was like a constant stream of travellers, and they were all like trying to make their way to what was promised to them as a big new adventure.
Right.
So seeing an opportunity, the Bender family turned their home into an inn and a general store. So they offered supplies, respite, food, and somewhere to lay your head if you were a weary traveller. Now, Kate, the daughter, was the most sort of social member of the Bender family, which made her the perfect face for the family run inn, and no doubt a major part of their plan. So when a guest arrived at the inn, they would be seated at a place of honour at a table, and this would be facing away from a cloth curtain, which separated the inn from the family's like main living quarters. So yeah. The guests would sit down and Kate would sit with them and, you know, start chatting to them. So she'd like distract them with her feminine wiles, probably. And while she was doing that, one of the other Benders would approach the curtain. Now, with the victim's head outlined through the thin cloth, one of the Benders would attack them and smash their skull in with like a hammer. And the body would then be dropped through a trapdoor into the basement. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Once the body... This is horrible, but I'm like, what a slick operation.
Even slicker, once the body was in the basement, the Benders would like strip it of any clothes and any valuables, you know, take all of their belongings and then bury the body in a mass grave in the garden. Like, money was certainly part of their motivation to kill, but a lot of their victims wouldn't have that much money. They would be quite poor. And it suggests that the family, I guess, simply enjoyed killing. Now, as people continued disappearing, usually after visiting the Benders, like, inn, the surrounding communities began to grow suspicious. And it wasn't just, like, lone travellers either. It was entire families, like, you know, families with young children were going missing as well. Now, after one somewhat prominent family went missing in this particular area, their friend, Dr. William York, he travelled in search of them. But Dr. York also went missing. So mm-hmm. His brother, who was a colonel in the army, he came to the Benders Inn asking about his brother. And the Benders told Colonel York that his brother had probably been killed by the Native Americans in the area or had met some sort of like normal-ish fate for that time. Yeah. But as part of Colonel York's investigation, he spoke to like lots of people in the area, and he heard like quite a number of worrying rumours about the Bender family. And he even uncovered several witnesses who claimed that the Benders had threatened them with violence or even to actually kill them. So when York returned to the inn to confront the family, he found it completely empty. The Benders had disappeared. So Colonel York's like party, because it had like he'd got a few other people with him, some investigators, they searched the building for like any sign of what could have happened. And that's when they discovered the trapdoor to the basement, which was covered in bloodstains. So they began like digging around the property, and they actually found 11 bodies, and these were all murdered by the Benders. A manhunt was immediately launched for the murderers. The Benders' wagon was found a few miles away from their home, but the family, like themselves, had disappeared. Mm-hmm. And some thought that, you know, they might have been killed by vigilantes, and others thought that they'd like maybe just left the country, just done a runner. So there were numerous sightings of them over the years, but no one ever really discovered exactly where they'd gone. So if we fast forward to 1889, on October the 22nd, a trial got underway in the town of Niles, Michigan, and a woman called Almira Munro had accused her adult daughter, Sarah Eliza Davis, of stealing a frying pan, some pewter plates, and a pair of infant stockings. Now,
wow.
Serious criminal activity there. So the courtroom was absolutely packed when the trial began, but hardly anyone there was interested, like, in the charges of theft. Most people who were there believed that Almira Monroe and her Sarah Eliza Davis were actually hiding something a bit more sinister. Like, they had become convinced that after about two decades that they'd found Ma and Kate Bender. Of the 16 witnesses that were brought to the stand to identify them, seven were positive that they were the Benders, and seven were equally positive that they weren't. And the remaining two couldn't come to a definitive conclusion. Wow. So eventually, these two ladies' defense lawyers were actually able to prove that they were definitely not the Benders, and they were released, which was lucky for them, because I guess that they would have been probably executed for their crimes. Yeah. And they hadn't committed them. Ultimately, the final fate of the actual Bender family was never established. Like, for years, rumors abounded, you know, that they'd been spotted here and there around the country. But most people thought that persons unknown had, like, caught up to them and quietly exacted their own justice. But like I say, nothing definitive ever came to light. The family of the Benders, although I have to say quite a lot of doubt has been placed, like, around the fact if they were actually a blood-related family.
Yeah.
They quickly became known as the Bloody Benders. And, you know, still to this day are classed as America's first serial killer family. So I know they only found, like, a small amount. There were lots of other crimes around the area that were attributed, lots of other murders that the bodies weren't just found in the garden. There was, like, lots more victims. But something interesting that I found about this is that a writer who would have been a young child at the time of the Bloody Benders, and one who allegedly has, like, a clear, stark memory of them, was Laura Ingalls Wilder. Have you heard of Laura Ingalls?
No.
Laura Ingalls is best known for writing the Little House on the Prairie series.
Oh, God.
Her family lived out on the prairie in the late 1800s, and her life out there encompassed run-ins, arguments with other settlers, problems with the natives of that area,
yeah,
and, like, constant fear of illness, death, and natural disasters. And much of that is chronicled in the Little House series. But one unsettling encounter was left out of the story. Now, if you can decide if you believe this or not, but she says that, and she would have been a very young child at this time, but she says that the community in which she lived, which was very nearby, had a horrible feeling that they knew, like, what the Benders were actually doing, and that when they were eventually discovered, a call sort of went out in the community, and it was one that her father himself answered. So I've got a quote here, and it says, "Pa Ingalls disappeared with his rifle one night. He told Ma Ingalls, 'The vigilantes are called out.' Laura said that her father came back, like, later the following day."
Yeah.
"And afterwards, whenever the subject of the Benders or of hunting the Benders would be brought up, Pa Ingalls would always say that the family would never be found." So she relayed this at a book fair in the late 70s, and she did add, like, interesting points about the Bloody Benders, like how her family would visit the inn, but they would never, like, go inside. They would just take water from the well. And she also stated how the Benders' garden was always freshly, like, ploughed, but nothing ever grew there.
Oh, God.
So, believe what you will, did the Benders disappear and get away with it and just settle somewhere else? Or did Laura Ingalls Wilder's dad and other men from the area exact their own brand of justice. Yeah. But I think it's a really interesting little case, because not only is it like officially the first American serial killing family, but, you know, it just sort of sets the scene of how it must have been back then, you know, how easy it would have been to get away with it.
And yeah, definitely.
Maybe, you know, maybe if they hadn't have taken this particular prominent family, then, you know, maybe they would have gone on and kept doing it for years and years and years, you know?
Yeah, you just don't know.
No, you don't.
That's what I quite like about historical cases, is that, I don't know, it's interesting how easily you could have got away with things back then.
Yeah, definitely.
Without all the things that we have now.
Absolutely. And I think as well, it just shows, doesn't it, how back in the day it was even easier to blame it on particular groups or minorities, because that was the way of life.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think if you were seen as a bit unscrupulous or a bit of a dodgy character, you could easily have something pinned on you, because that's all they were going on.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think, I wonder how many more victims were actually blamed on Native Americans, because this was the Wild West, that perhaps was like, weren't, it was like maybe this murderous family or other ne'er-do-wells.
Yeah, that leads really well onto my case, because it is a miscarriage of justice.
Well, off you go.
Well, I'm just going to blow my nose first. Can you edit this bit out? Okay. So, as I was saying, I'm going to tell you about a miscarriage of justice that happened in Glasgow, Scotland, in December of 1908. So, we're going way back in time. And on the 21st of December 1908, the Adams family, a respectable family that lived in central Glasgow on Queen's Terrace, were settling down for the evening when they were startled by a thud from above them, and then three really sort of loud, definite, like, knocks on the floor. And they lived below a wealthy and elderly woman called Marion Gilchrist. And Marion had openly spoken to them about her fears of getting robbed and, like, all the crime that was going on in the city at the time. She was a very fearful woman. And she'd always said, like, she'll knock on the floor if she needs help. So instantly they were like, I mean, I'm sure they didn't say these exact words, but shit, the woman upstairs is in trouble. So Mr. Adams, the man of the house, leaves his flat to go upstairs to check on Marion. Now, I have a little picture of these flats, and they're lovely flats. We're not talking like your 1980s, like, cement blocks. We're talking beautiful, like, Victorian houses that were split up kind of thing. So it looks like quite a nice area. So Mr. Adams leaves his flat and he bumps into a young lady on the stairs. So a short time earlier, Marion had sent her servant, Helen Lambray, she's called, out to get an evening paper. And it just so happened that when Helen was returning, Mr. Adams, alarmed by the sound, was leaving his flat as well. So he tells her about the noise and they go up to the flat to investigate. Of course, Helen, being Marion's servant, had a key. And as she opened the door, a smartly dressed man just runs out in between them. You'd absolutely crap yourself, wouldn't you?
Oh, God, yeah, totally.
So they start to explore the flat. Now, I also have a floor plan of this flat. And it is a large flat. So there's many, many rooms. But they start looking round and in the direction that this man appeared from, behind him is the dining room, and they go in, and Marion Gilchrist's body is found in a pool of blood next to the fireplace on the floor, and it is quite obvious that she's suffered a violent attack because there's so much blood. So Mr. Adams rushes out into the street to sort of see if he can alert anyone, but he can't see anyone there. It's quite a, I mean, it's December and it's the evening, so I don't think they were having Christmas markets back then. It was probably quite quiet. So he can't really alert anyone, so he goes to get his doctor, and his doctor summons the police. So straight away, the police are really like hot onto this because she's a wealthy lady, and they suspect that it's robbery because they managed to work out that a really valuable brooch is missing. Although there's lots of other jewellery in the property worth at least £3,000, and that jewellery has been left. So it seems that either the person who killed her knew exactly what they wanted and it was that brooch, possibly they got disturbed, or maybe robbery wasn't the motive at all. But there's lots of, I suppose you'd call it publicity, people talking about this, and soon a 14-year-old girl named Mary Barrow comes forward, and she says that a man ran into her around the time of the incident on the same street, and she believed that he was running away from the scene. Her description differs greatly from the description of Helen and Mr. Adams. So the police start thinking maybe there's two people, and they start circulating descriptions. Then a tip comes in that a man has gone to like a pawnbroker's and took in Miss Gilchrist's brooch. So they start looking into that man, and that man happens to be Oscar Slater. Now, Oscar Slater was a 39-year-old man, 5'8", broad, with a short black mustache. I have pictures of him as well, and he looks very much like a man of that era. Now, he claimed to be a dentist and a precious stone dealer. However, that wasn't entirely true. So, he was actually just like a gambler who had no real occupation. And he'd spend a lot of his time in billiard rooms and clubs. He was quite a drinker. A bit of like a troublemaker, but nothing huge, nothing violent in his past. And he'd been seen in this pawnbroker's with a young woman. And the police managed to find out that himself and this young woman had actually sailed on a boat set for New York from Liverpool, just a few days after Marion Gilchrist was murdered. So the police are like, shit, it must be him. He's running away.
Mm.
So they are hot on his trail, and they even travel over to New York in order to arrest him. And he's quickly arrested. They find him. And this is when their case against him kind of starts to fall apart, because they do a bit more research on this brooch that he took to the pawn shop. And this brooch had actually been in circulation in various pawn shops around Glasgow since the 18th of November, which is 5 days before the murder. So it can't be the same brooch. And it had three rows of diamonds on it, whereas the one stolen from Miss Gilchrist, only had one row. So there's an obvious huge discrepancy, and the thing that linked into the crime is now void. But the police don't have any other suspects, and I mean, he's a gambler, and he fits it. So they keep going after him, and they actually fly over Helen, Mary and Mr. Adams to New York to do like a what's it called, like an identity parade. Yeah. But going against all sort of protocol or anything they're meant to do, they actually show them pictures of him first and be like, oh, this is the man we think it is. Please, can you identify the man you think it is out of all these? But they'd already been shown him, so it's such confirmation bias.
Mm.
And Mary and Helen both chose Oscar Slater out of the lineup and were like, yeah, we think it's him. But Mr. Adams said that he couldn't be sure at all, and he wasn't leaning towards sort of Oscar Slater anyway. But it's definitely a case of the police wanted it to be him. So they were like, oh, well, 2 out of 3 say it's him. They press forward with charges against Oscar. They're completely disregarding the fact that they thought it was 2 people now. They're completely disregarding the fact that there's no actual link to the crime. And they now find out that the tickets that he'd booked to America had been booked way before the murder. So it wasn't like he murdered her and fled. He was already planning that trip. But nevertheless, the police continue and the prosecution case is mega weak. But in Glasgow, there's quite a lot of outrage that this like wealthy, well thought of lady was killed, and they just really want a prosecution. And it's that kind of, there's so much momentum behind it. So this leads a Glasgow jury to convict Slater, and he's sentenced to hanging. Around this time, a few people, especially people connected to the police who weren't part of that investigation, start to come forward and question the verdict. And they, hang on, I've got his name. It's Lieutenant Trench is the guy who heads this up, but they're all police officers, but not the police officers that were working on the case. They start to question the validity of his conviction, and they lead a campaign which actually managed to gather the support of 20,000 people who sign a petition to like stop him being hung, and this actually saves his life. But he's not released, and he spends 19 years in jail for murder. So after the trial, his case becomes a subject of a book by a guy called William Ruffland, and this is one of the first examples of like a true crime book whatever. And he explores the inconsistencies in the evidence at the trial, and he calls for the verdict to be overturned entirely. So they've saved him from being hung, but he's still in prison. But it never happens. Then in 1914, the Secretary of State for Scotland, who is Thomas MacKinnon Wood, does order a review. And again, this fails to quash the conviction. But there's definitely a lot of people, and like people who have quite a considerable amount of power, that are questioning this now.
Mm.
Then finally, in 1927, on the back of another book being published, they start to look into the conviction and Marion Gilchrist's murder again. They are unable to find any other suspects or links that, or anything that links anyone else to the case. But in 1928, his conviction is quashed, and he's released after 19 years in prison and given £6,000 in compensation.
Wow.
He moved to Aish. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's A-Y-R-S-H-I-R-E.
Ayrshire,
thank you. And he lives there until January 1948, where he passes away at the age of 79. like, this case did a lot of damage to the Glasgow police force in the end, because it showed kind of such a fractured nature of it. And it's alleged that there's people within the investigation that held back on a lot of evidence, and that when other tips were like called in to the police that didn't fit with the Oscar Slater narrative, they weren't even recorded. So it still remains a mystery who killed Marion Gilchrist, and we will probably never know now. So yeah, that is the case of Marion Gilchrist and Oscar Slater.
So interesting.
It is, and like, obviously this is just sort of a quick overview, but there seems to be quite a lot about it. So I found a really good article on the Glasgow Police Museum website about it. There's also been a book called The Thin Blue Line by Douglas Grant, published in 1973, which covers the topic quite extensively. And for such an old crime, there's lots of photographs. So there's photographs of the crime scene. There's photographs of things like Oscar Slater's card, where it said he's a diamond dealer and precious stone dealer and dentist. It was just an interesting and like quite a, I don't know, the fact that I could find pictures, I was like, oh, that's actually really cool. So I think I've mentioned this book again, but it's called Murder Maps. You can get it from Waterstones, Amazon, whatever. But it's cases between 1811 and 1911. And it's almost like a picture book, like nothing particularly gory, but it's got like pictures of the houses at the time. And I find that really helps me like visualize a case when I'm researching it. Proper big up that book if you are interested in any sort of kind of historical fiction, not fiction, historical crime kind of thing.
Yeah, you've mentioned it before. I think it sounds like an excellent book, to be fair.
Yeah, it's only like little snippets. Like the whole bit on this Oscar Slater case is, I mean, it's quite big text. It's only one page. But it's got then like three pages of pictures. So if you like a true crime picture book, it is bloody brilliant. But yeah, I just thought it was interesting, and it's lots of firsts to do with like people writing about true crime and selling it as a book.
Yeah.
Thought that was interesting. So yeah, poor Oscar Slater. I mean, it does sound like he wasn't the most reputable of people, but like we've said, shouldn't be pinned on someone because it's an easy scapegoat. So there we go, that was mine for today. I hope you enjoyed it.
Well, I did. I knew nothing about that case, and I found it very interesting.
Yeah, I can imagine it being made into like a Miss Marple or, you know, like something like that. But yeah, I have no idea what we're gonna do next week, but by the end of today I will have decided.
Yeah, well, you know, everyone can be surprised. It's fine.
Surprise for me at the moment. So I hope everyone is keeping well out there in the run-up to Christmas, and everyone is keeping warm and isn't too stressed.
I second that.
Yeah. All right, we'll see you next week.
Yep, see you soon. Bye.
Bye.